and welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We're going to start off today's show with some music from the late folk singer Kate Wolf. This is from the album Back Roads, and this is the tune The Red Tail Hawk. A hawk, of course, that many of us see in this local area or in the Montreal area. Probably the most common hawk that people see, especially near highways and in agricultural areas. The Red Tail Hawk by Kate Wolf.
Songs across the sky. There's music in the waters flowing by, and you can hear a song each time the wind sighs. And the golden so long, love, since you said goodbye. My cabin's been as lonesome as a cry. There's comfort in the clouds drifting by. The golden rolling hills of California. The golden rolling hills of California. Yes, a neighbor came today to lend a hand. He saw it fix the road as best I can. There's just some things that need a man's hand. And the golden rolling hills of California. Songs across the sky. There's music in the waters flowing by. You can hear a song each time the wind sighs. The golden rolling hills of California. And the golden
And that was The Red Tail Hawk by Kate Wolf and the Wildwood Flower from the album Back Roads from 1976. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. So we have a good show for you today. Maybe you've heard about the issue with gas in England right now. that for a variety of reasons, there's kind of a run on gas in England, in Britain, and you know, there are lots of empty gas stations, and you know, I hear different reports. My brother lives there, so as far as I know, it is true. And recently, Radio EcoShock, which we often feature here on Equilibrium, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. Recently, Radio EcoShock covered the issue of natural gas and the prices of natural gas going really high in Europe and in England, and how this is causing a potential crisis. So we're going to play you that story, and it's primarily made up of an interview that Alex Smith did with Natasha Fielding, who is the Argus editor for European Natural Gas. So here is that story.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Can Europe keep the lights on?
That voice is not from a fringe podcaster looking for clicks. The public broadcasting network in Germany, Deutsche Welle, is seriously asking if Europe is heading for crisis in the coming months.
European gas stockpiles are now at their lowest levels in years, at a time when demand will jump during the cold winter months. And in the North Sea, winds have stopped blowing. Thousands of wind turbines there are producing drastically less energy. In Germany, wind power accounted for just over a fifth of Germany's electricity supply during the first half of this year. A year ago, wind made up 29% of the energy mix. Conventional energy sources, dirtier ones like coal, are filling that gap. The sudden reversal away from wind back to fossil fuels illustrates the difficulty of Europe's green transition. Wind is supposed to play a major role, but even Brussels can't control the weather.
That is from Deutsche Welle TV, September 16, 2021. Recently on Radio EcoShock, expert forecaster Judah Cohen warned us the signs are lining up for a colder, snowier winter this year in the Northern Hemisphere, and Europe is a target. Already natural gas shortages have pushed weird shortages in the supply chain and products going missing on the shelves. Power companies and industry are sliding backward into burning coal, when Europe is supposed to be slashing emissions. Europe's largest fertilizer company, which converts natural gas into nitrogen, has closed down. Two large gas sellers in the UK holding contracts with about a million homeowners have closed, bankrupt, in just the last week. Gas users in the UK are paying the highest rates in Europe. Can seniors and the poor afford to keep warm this winter? But it is not just Europe. Natural gas prices have already doubled in both Canada and the United States, with financial analysts at Goldman Sachs saying they could double again. And that's if La Nina and a weak jet stream drive Arctic extremes back into the plains and the Northeast. Northern China is another possible target for extreme cold this winter. The Chinese are outbidding all other Asian buyers for liquid natural gas shipments, just hiking that price up there. And the Chinese are starting to snatch Atlantic-bound shipments as well. The struggling Asian economies face another hurdle. I've reached a specialist in European gas markets to get the insider scoop for Europe and the world. In our second half hour, our scientist answers this real-world weather problem. You know extreme rainfall events are hitting all over the world. But aside from headline-grabbing floods in the U.S. Northeast and deadly ones in Northern Europe this summer, the actual amount of flooding has not kept up with very heavy rains falling. Why not? And is there a point where extreme rains will be revealed to become the floods never seen before? From the University of Freiburg, Manuela Brunner solves the riddle.
Radio EcoShock.
Natural gas helps keep Europeans warm, employed, and with the lights on. But if a colder winter forecast comes true, sky-high gas prices and electric bills, well, they're already driving protests and politics across Europe. And now Asia will pay more to fill their large needs. Major energy moves are afoot with implications for geopolitics and greenhouse gas emissions. You won't get much depth about this from TV news. An EcoShock listener tipped me a review of the situation published by Argus Media. They specialize in markets for energy and commodities. Recently, an insider gas roundup was written by the Argus editor for European natural gas, Natasha Fielding. From London, Natasha Fielding, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, great to be here.
Natural gas prices have doubled this year in Canada and in the US, but that is still cheap compared to the price hikes in the UK. What are you seeing there?
We have seen dramatic rises in European gas prices. It's happened kind of steadily over the course of the summer, but particularly in the past week or two, prices have really skyrocketed to fresh record highs. I mean, they haven't been this high for the decades.
And there have been some protests in some European cities against rising energy prices, especially for gas and electricity. Is this becoming a political issue?
It certainly is becoming a political issue, and it's hit mainstream news in the UK and also across the continent very recently.
Yes, we have the French presidential elections coming up next year, and France has had a number of street protests on a lot of issues, but I noticed that energy prices are coming into what people are complaining about.
Yeah, and it seems to me that people are concerned that the energy transition isn't happening fast enough. And so what you have is the kind of the need for fossil fuels as a backup for renewables. And when there isn't enough of those fossil fuels to go around, well, then you have a really brittle energy system.
Under popular pressure, the Spanish government is taking drastic steps. They will snatch back some profits from energy companies and pay that back on consumer bills. Do you know how that works? It sounds very unusual.
Yes, that is a rather unusual move. I don't know all the details of that, but governments are trying to do whatever they can not to pass on all of those extra costs to the consumers.
Well, I noticed in another Argus Energy article that I came across on your site that Spain also hopes to help consumers cope with huge bills by selling off almost $1 billion more carbon emissions permits. And to me, that sounds a little bit like selling indulgences for greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, it will create more deadly air pollution. What do you think about that technique?
Yeah, it certainly seems like a short-term fix to the solution that isn't really going to be doing anything for the climate in the longer term.
And then we have Poland. Most of their electricity is generated by burning dirty lignite coal. The Polish government has promised to kick the habit and get more renewables, but now Polish homeowners are paying some of the highest electric rates in Europe. What do you see in the Polish gas and power generating market?
Poland, more so than a lot of continental Europe, is still burning the dirty kind of lignite coal for power generation. It's much more exposed to fossil fuels than a lot of the rest of Europe, which is further along in the energy transition.
And Germany is a very complex picture. They've been trying to get a new gas pipeline from Russia. They're looking for gas wherever they can find it. And yet Germany has installed a lot of renewables, a lot of solar, and they get a lot of wind from Denmark. Could you talk to us a bit about the problems in the German gas outlook for this winter?
It's certainly true that there's a lot of renewables in the German energy power mix, but there's also a lot of reliance on lignite coal and especially gas. And gas fills in when renewables are not producing enough power. So, if the wind isn't blowing and if the sun isn't shining, then in the German system at the moment you need a backup. And there just hasn't been enough gas around this summer for the underground gas storage levels in Germany to reach a satisfactory level. And so that's been behind some of the considerable increases in gas prices.
Ireland is warned of possible blackouts.
Does Europe have enough gas storage that they can really bulk up for an unusually cold winter?
Well, so if you look at the figures on an aggregate level for Europe, the gas storage levels, then they're actually high enough to allow for a repeat of the quickest withdrawals of the past decade. That is to say that this suggests that there is enough in storage to get through a really severe winter. However, if you drill down more on a regional basis, then you'll see that it differs a lot by country. So if you take Germany, which has more storage capacity than anywhere else in Europe, with the exception of Ukraine, storage levels are not high enough to allow for a repeat of the strongest drawdown that there's been in a decade. On a country-by-country basis, there are more serious security of supply concerns.
And to help reach emissions goals for climate, the European Union countries added a price per ton of carbon burned. How much is that, and how is the carbon price figuring in this current energy price and supply crunch?
Yes, the price of carbon is certainly playing a big role. What we have is a kind of circular system. So the power sector, you have coal and gas, which compete with each other. And if there's not enough gas around, then gas prices will need to rise enough that it's more profitable to burn coal than it is to burn gas. But coal is a dirtier fuel than gas, which means more permits, more carbon permits are required. So that in itself will bring up the carbon costs. And the fact that gas prices are rising will increase the costs of emissions even more. So it's a bit of a circular system. We've seen also, alongside the dramatic increases in gas prices, we've also seen carbon costs at record highs this summer.
So all that adds up when you're just in a household and you're getting a bill at the end of the month to a bit of a shock.
Certainly, yeah. It's been a bit of a shock, I think, how much household and consumer bills have risen already, and these latest dramatic price increases are going to really increase the burden on end consumers.
Traders in the market are bidding on gas months away or sometime in the future for contracts in the future, and that is going to help determine what will happen to the actual bills that people get in their homes and industries have to pay. So are you able to see that sort of ahead of time to do some forecasting about prices?
Yes, certainly. And I think part of the issue here is that there's a significant risk premium added for gas prices for delivery in the winter. So traders will be thinking about the worst case scenario, which, you know, might be severely cold weather or an unplanned disruption. You know, if a certain key supplier has something break in the middle of the winter, what would that mean, especially if that coincides with really cold weather, you know, maybe in Europe as well as globally in Asia? So people are definitely factoring in that kind of worst-case scenario thinking, and that plays out in forward gas prices, and that will already be hitting consumers for their energy bills. So, you know, at the moment, gas demand is not that high in Europe. It's a really seasonal pattern. So, you know, as soon as it gets cold and people are heating their homes, that's when gas consumption across the region will really ramp up. And that hasn't happened yet. So it's really the fear of what could happen that is driving prices up.
I found an interesting case in the Netherlands. The Dutch should be able to produce lots of extra gas for this winter. After all, they sit on the, and I may mispronounce this, on the Groningen field, the largest natural gas field in Europe, 10th largest in the world. But that is out of the picture and soon to close. Why?
That's an interesting case. So producing gas from the Groningen field, which is an onshore field in the Netherlands, leads to increased seismic activity in the area. So there have been small earthquakes, which have caused damage to homes. And it became a massive political issue in the country. And that led the government to saying it will shut down production from the field as soon as it can, while also ensuring that homes can still be kept warm. and that essential businesses will still have the gas that they need.
The biggest gas field in Europe is actually set to be closed down in 2022, I believe.
Yes. So the plan is that the field will stop producing next year already, but it will not shut completely for another couple of years. It will stay on standby just in case it's needed.
The other weird thing about that is I just presumed, well, that's what you get with fracking, lots of earthquakes. But they're not using fracking, I don't think. It surprises me that conventional gas production can still lead to earthquakes.
Yeah, that's right. It's been a long kind of fraught political debate. I think the catalyst for deciding to completely shut down the field was a slightly larger earthquake that happened a couple of years ago, causing damage to houses. And it really became an issue where the government felt the pressure from public opinion to say it would do something as soon as possible to stop producing from the field.
Well, what about Norway? Can we count on them to fill the gas gap if Europe gets a punishing winter?
Well, by our calculations, there is some scope for production to be a little bit higher than it was last winter. And this is because of extra production from the big swing field, which is called Troll. It's the largest producing gas field in Norway. And they've just brought online a new section of the field, which is expected to lift the field's peak production. However, this will only just be enough to offset declining output from more mature areas of the Norwegian continental shelf. So, in fact, most North Sea fields are in steady decline. So from year to year, their production will decrease, and that's not been offset by newer fields starting up. There have been some new oil and gas fields that have started up in recent years, but that's been outpaced by the decline from other fields. So I would expect the Norwegians to produce a bit more than last winter, but certainly not enough to plug the gap.
Well, that's another good reason for Europeans to switch over to renewables, because those gas fields are not going to stand up.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Spain took one of the most drastic steps this week to rein in prices, saying it would take back almost 3 billion euros in profits from energy companies. We are going to take away those extraordinary profits that the energy companies are making. They can afford it, and we are going to redirect them to consumers to cap the gas bill in the face of the foreseeable increase in the price of gas in the coming months. And we are also going to reduce the electric bill.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest, Natasha Fielding, is an energy editor for Global Energy and Commodities Price Monitor Argus Media. We are looking at the steep rise of natural gas and, of course, the electricity generated from it as we head into what has been predicted could be a cold winter. It's a little early yet. We don't know for sure, but there are signs that it may be a colder winter. Natasha, let's pull back to the reality of a global energy market. Tell us about the role of China's industry resurgence after the initial shock of the COVID pandemic.
China's gas demand has been increasing at a very rapid pace, particularly if you compare it to Europe's incremental gas demand. So the increase in China's economy has been accompanied by an increase in its gas demand, particularly so as China is looking to move away from burning the dirtier coal and instead switching to gas. This has been a key part of the global picture in terms of, you know, also looking from the European perspective, because China is swallowing up some of that extra gas supply and that leaves less for Europe.
Can China just outbid everyone else for natural gas, and are their purchases distorting the price market for others?
It's certainly true that China has a lot fewer options for satisfying its demand than Europe does. So in Europe, there's a large amount of underground storage capacity. And in addition to a lot of options for pipeline gas, Europe also has a lot of receiving terminals for liquefied natural gas. China, by contrast, does not have a lot of underground storage capacity and does not have a great amount of flexibility for on the pipeline gas side. So if it needs the extra gas, then Chinese companies will outbid their Asian counterparts for that gas. And that's what we can expect in the winter, I would say.
And where does Australia's large natural gas exports fit into this global picture of supply?
So Australia exports a lot of gas as liquefied natural gas. So that's when the gas is liquefied and it goes on tankers and they sail around the world to wherever they're needed. Most of Australia's gas exports stay within the Asia-Pacific region. That is satisfying, including Chinese gas demand.
And can Russia's state-owned gas giant Gazprom rush in to add more power for Europe if needed?
We don't believe that Russia's state-owned company Gazprom has enough spare gas production to be able to send that extra supply to Europe. Particularly this summer, Russia's domestic storage reserves were very low, so Russia had to send a lot of gas just to refill its domestic storage inventories, which is part of the reason why it didn't send more gas to Europe. And while Russian domestic production is certainly on the rise, and we expect it to be higher this year than it was last year, we don't believe that Russia will be able to send a lot more gas to Europe to plug that gap.
Some American financial analysts say one factor driving higher gas prices was the unnatural heat wave last summer. Demand for air conditioning was so high that gas plants that would have been shut down for the summer were kept open. And in addition to gas, heat, and power in the winter, we now have blistering new heat waves that add a whole new season for gas plants that meet peak demands. We've got a summer air conditioning season. And I wonder if that's going to become a factor in Europe and particularly in southern Europe as the planet warms up.
Yes, I do think that's increasingly becoming a phenomenon. And I mean, in southern Europe already, there's a lot of air conditioning demand. So, you know, Italy and Spain already have a bump in their gas demand in the hottest summer months. What I think could be a growing trend for the future is other European countries, more of the kind of northern Europe, having to install more air conditioning, which then increases its gas demand. And like you say, could bring another peak gas demand period, aside from the winter heating demand season.
And in the United States, natural gas prices are almost double their quite low price from a year ago. And natural gas prices are about double in Canada, too. CNBC reports, quote, "If there is an especially cold winter, Goldman Sachs analysts see the potential for another doubling of price." Natasha, is the gas market normally this variable?
The variability of the gas market has certainly increased in recent years. And I would say we have had a very variable couple of years. Last summer, because of the COVID pandemic, we had depressed gas demand globally. And we've seen it really rebound this year. So that's been a stark contrast. But I think to a certain extent, it's a systemic thing. Because of this energy transition we have, the energy system has become a lot more brittle. So in previous years, if you would go back 5 years, if we had a similar situation, there would be more coal plants online and more scope to burn fuel oil rather than gas to generate power. It's a major advantage that we don't have as much scope to burn those dirtier fuels now from a climate perspective. But it also means that there is much more chance of gas prices spiking because you just don't have that flexibility to switch to those other sources. I mean, gas is a backup for renewables, but what about if you don't have that backup for gas anymore?
But there does come a point where it's just plain cheaper to go back to coal and oil than it is to burn gas if gas prices stay high enough long enough. Have we already reached that point?
We have, yes. We've already seen a resurgence of coal burn in the power sector in Europe this summer at the expense of gas. And we're starting to see more oil being burned. In Europe, there isn't that much fuel oil that can be burned for power generation. It's a bit of a different story in Asia, where there is more fuel oil demand. But this is certainly something we have already started to see this summer.
Yes, it's a bit of a mess from a climate perspective because we're starting to see a slide back down the ladder into the dirtier fuels, including oil and coal. The U.S. Energy Information Administration says, quote, as a result of the higher expected natural gas prices, the forecast share of electricity generation from coal rises from 20% in 2020 to about 24% in both 2021 and 2022. So once again, as your article tells us, higher natural gas prices can lead to an increase in coal burning and more greenhouse gas emissions.
That is the result, and it's a real setback for climate goals. But when you just don't have enough gas in the system, it's a fallback option to have more coal burn, more oil being burnt. Yeah, like I said, renewables are still fairly intermittent in a lot of Europe. And if you can't fully rely on those renewables, then you have to have the fallback option of, you know, a fossil fuel. And if there's not enough gas around, then you have to turn to those dirtier fuels.
And this can extend into the future because some companies may have decided they're going to mothball their coal or oil-burning electricity production facilities, or some governments may have decided they're going to mandate that that happens. But now with the high price of natural gas and not quite enough renewables yet, they may decide to keep these dirty plants open for years into the future.
Yeah, it certainly seems that companies and governments are stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, there are plans throughout Europe to phase out coal plants. There are also plans to phase out nuclear capacity in Germany next year. And all that puts a lot more stress and a lot more burden on the gas system to be able to make up for that. And when you're in a situation of there not being enough gas around, that's a real dilemma.
Do you see the current high gas prices as a temporary variation in the market, or could this be the start of a new period of difficulties where we have a tough time reaching even the most basic emissions targets and getting the energy that we need?
It's a difficult one to predict. I mean, partly the weather is always a massive uncertainty factor, and that will have a really big impact. But I would say it could be a medium-term trend for the gas market. And the fact that we have quite low European underground gas storage inventories headed into this winter could have an impact for years to come. Because if you have very high storage inventories at the beginning of the winter, that greatly increases the likelihood of there being quite a bit of gas left in storage at the end of the winter. Whereas the situation we have now, it's already looking very likely that we will need, that gas prices will need to stay high enough for enough gas supply to come to Europe to replenish that those gas storages next summer. So it certainly looks like it's going to filter through to the next, at least the next couple of years, although obviously, you know, weather remains a big uncertainty factor.
And as we wrap up here, Natasha, as you say in your Argus article, gas prices will need to soar enough to force deeper demand-side responses this winter. That's kind of an industry way of saying that consumers will have to feel some pain, industry will have to feel some pain, in order to force those changes that we need to renewables, no pain, no gain, no climate gains. How do you see that balance between our current dependence on fossil fuels and our dire need to stop burning them?
It's a very tricky balance, and it's really coming to the fore at the moment. I mean, just last week, Europe's largest fertilizer producer, Yara, said it will curtail around 40% of its ammonia output because of this rise in gas prices. So we're already seeing a big impact on industry of these soaring gas prices. And that's just because there's not enough gas around, so industry is going to have to burn less gas. And that has an impact on a whole range of other sectors. So because of these fertilizer plants being closed, one of the byproducts of fertilizer production is CO2. CO2 is used for meat packaging and also to stun animals before they're slaughtered. So this is going to have a big knock-on effect for the meat industry as a result. That's just one example of how these soaring gas prices have filtered through to a number of economic sectors. And that's something that I would expect to see much more of in the coming weeks and months because of these high gas prices.
From Argus Media Group in London, we have been speaking with European Natural Gas Editor Natasha Fielding. Natasha, thank you for sharing your company expertise with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been great.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
And that was a story from Radio EcoShock from Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. And Alex Smith was mainly interviewing there Natasha Fielding, who is the Argus editor for European Natural Gas. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So recently, last week, of course, was the first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. And I did want to cover something to do with that here on Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And, of course, Quebec did not celebrate it. Well, celebrated is the wrong term. Did not observe it as a national holiday where, you know, for example, it was a day off work. But it was nevertheless observed throughout Canada. Of course, it also coincides with Orange Shirt Day, which is a way that people remember the victims of the residential school system. And of course, that's what gave rise to the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. And that was prompted by the bodies of children in graves at a school in British Columbia. And since then, more and more have been found. And I think we're up to something like 6,000 bodies in unmarked graves, which, you know, is a sign of a huge genocide. It's one of the signs of the genocide on Indigenous people here in North America, and specifically here in Canada. So I found a little message that Murray St. Clair, who was, of course, the former chair of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, gave on the occasion of the first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. So I wanted to play that. Murray St. Clair, of course, is a First Nations lawyer who served as chairman of the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission from 2009 to 2015. He had also served as a judge in Manitoba from 1988 to 2009, being the first Indigenous judge appointed in the province. And later on, St. Clair was appointed to the Senate of Canada in 2016. But in November 2020, just last year, he announced his retirement from the Senate January 31st, 2021. So I wanted to play, as I said, his message. He is also the chancellor now of Queen's University in Kingston. And so he gave this message, I guess, on the Queen's University website as part of his role as the Queen's University Chancellor. So here is Murray St. Clair with an important message on the occasion of the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation.
Hello, everybody. As Chancellor of Queen's University, I'm glad to be able to take some time today to be able to address you on the new national holiday for Reconciliation that was one of the calls to action for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, which I was also proud to chair. The call to action that gave rise to this national holiday was an important one as part of our discussions, because when we looked at the entire work that we had done, we came to a realization that most of the people that we had spoken to in the general public told us that they knew nothing about this. Nobody had ever disclosed to them what happened as part of Canada's history. And no one had ever told them, in fact, that there was even a residential school system. There were so many people out there who had come from many generations of Canadians going back to the 1600s and 1700s who had no idea that residential schools existed and that children were being taken from their families, often against the will of the families, in order to be placed in those institutions. And they certainly never knew anything about what went on in those schools, and particularly the levels of abuse that occurred. The survivors themselves, of course, had been trying to get their message out for a long time. They were talking to the media, they were talking to the general public, they would talk to whoever would listen to them. But no one picked up on that message. Partly, I think, because there were so many people who just didn't believe that it could happen in this country. One of the impacts of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in my view, is that now people believe. Now people understand that it did happen. Now people realize that, in fact, this is part of Canada's history. This is part of what has given rise to this nation. But it's not a part in which we can take pride. It's not a part in which we as Canadians, those who have generations of ancestors that go back to the beginning of time, can say, as is a part of our history that we can proudly hold up to the rest of the world and say, look how good we are, because we can't. We weren't. Therefore, the question of how to acknowledge that, but also to put into it a message of hope for reconciliation, of hope that we can come to terms with this past, of hope that we will be able to establish a new and better relationship between ourselves as Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people, can in fact be the pathway to the future. It's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a lot of time. When I was chairing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I realized, of course, that getting to the truth was hard, but getting to the reconciliation is going to be harder. We know that there are people who are going to resist telling the truth of the story, but more importantly, there are people who are not going to quite realize the magnitude of the change that we are calling for in this country. We are not only calling for people to understand this truth and to accept it, but we're also calling on people to recognize that there came with it benefits and privileges that now are bestowed upon the settler population, that were bestowed at great cost to Indigenous people. The loss of land, the loss of resources, the loss of access to their own potential as human beings is part of the price that Indigenous people have paid for the existence of this nation. So we need people to understand that. We need people to think about that. But we also need to get people to think about what is it that we can do properly to come to terms with this. What, in fact, are the changes that we need to start to think about? One of them is we have to learn how to talk to and about each other with greater respect than has been the case in the past. Our education system in the residential schools was bad. There's no question of that. We worked hard to take away language, culture, and a sense of history, a sense of validity from indigenous people. But it also did the same thing in the public schools as well. The public education system that most people in this country have received spent a great deal of time in talking about the history of this country, in saying that colonialism was good, in saying that indigenous people stood in the way of national trends. Of indigenous people, in fact, didn't have any rights, that they were heathens, they were savages, they were less than the settler population. And in fact, mythologies grew up in part of our public education system, and that is that we were told, and I can remember being told this in the public schools, that indigenous people were lucky that Europeans came here and saved them from extinction. We were told that, in fact, we didn't have a culture worth protecting. We didn't have a tradition that was worth respecting as well. But what does that do to you as an individual? Well, it belittles you. Not only belittled you in the eyes of others, but it belittled you to yourself. You feel a sense of shame just about being indigenous. You feel, in fact, that anything that's going on in your own life that shows an inadequacy, your inability to play sports at the same level or at all as others, is because there's something wrong with you. It's your fault, or your family's fault, or your community's fault. There are lots of other examples of situations like that. The poverty that we experienced growing up as indigenous people, we were led to believe, was because of our own inadequacies. Our parents, we were told, couldn't hold down jobs. Our parents had drinking problems. Our parents were inadequate as parents. Our children now are being taken away from indigenous families in large numbers, partly because of this legacy from residential schools, this mythology that indigenous families can't be trusted to raise their children properly. On the scantiest of evidence, babies are being taken away from mothers right in the hospitals just after they are born. Not because the mother has done anything wrong, but because the mother might do something wrong. She might not be able to parent properly. And when she has, in fact, proven that she can, then by that time that she's ready to take her child back, they'll tell her the child is already bonded with another family. There are lots of legacies of residential schools out there for us to see. One of them also is this. All people who have gone to public schools in this country have been taught that myth of inferiority on the part of indigenous people. But they've also been taught the myth of European superiority. They've been taught that European civilizations that came here were far more advanced than indigenous civilizations, and that's just not true. They're taught that indigenous people lacked civilization laws and ways of self-governing, and that settler populations brought those wonderful practices here, and that they're much better off as a result, but in fact that is not the case. We need to come to an understanding of what the legacy of residential schools is, not only for indigenous people, but the legacy of the residential school system and the public school system is for non-indigenous people as well. And ultimately, this process of coming to terms with this past, of reconciling our relationship, means that we have to aim towards establishing a relationship of mutual respect. But keep in mind that in order for us to get there, firstly, indigenous people need to be given the opportunity to develop their self-respect. And that's going to take us some time. We may not achieve reconciliation within my lifetime or within the lifetime of my children. But we will be able to achieve it if we all commit to working towards it properly. And part of that commitment is that every year we will stand up together and we will say, never again. what we did was wrong in this country, and we will never allow that to happen again. So on September 30th, I ask you to stand up. I ask you to take the time to think about all of that. I ask you to commit to a better relationship with and between settlers, population, non-Indigenous people, and Indigenous people in this country, so that as a country we can say that we are the better for it, that we have learned from this, and that we will continue to learn from this until we know that all of the impacts of the residential school system have been put in their proper place. Thank you for this time to be able to speak with you. Miigwech.
And that was Marie St. Clair's message as the Queen's University Chancellor on the occasion of the first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Marie St. Clair was the chairman of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he is a First Nations lawyer and a former judge who served as a judge in Manitoba from 1988 to 2009, being the first Indigenous judge appointed in the province of Manitoba. He was also a member of the Senate of Canada from 2016 until 2020. Last year, he announced his retirement. So you are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. That's all the time we have left in the show today. Thanks for listening. And you can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. We also have a podcast connected to the show, which you can find by going to www.equilibrium.podbean.com. And you can find it on Spotify just by looking for the Equilibrium Radio podcast. And my name is Ryan Young. Thanks for listening to the show. And we'll be here again, same time, same place, next week on CKUT 90.3 FM with Equilibrium, an environmental radio show, which seeks to bring you as much information as possible that is of an ecological nature or has some bearing on our environments or ecology or concepts of nature or activism connected to environmentalism and so on. So, as usual, thanks for listening to the show and have a great rest of your day. My name is Ryan Young for Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're going to leave you with some music, and I guess this is a recent piece of music. I don't know if you would call this techno or not. It's from an artist called You Man, and the tune is called Birdcage. So enjoy that.
Hold up, this is not my thing. This music is tired. I'm sorry. He's gonna have to play something else. Let me go talk to the DJ.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
He's a messenger, teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell the massive them to remember Jah. That's all I need when I am. Well, CKUT is a messenger, teaching the youth about roots and culture.
Feel the beat, feel the beat.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune into CKUT, always.
Hello, check it out.
Slim Kid.
Fat Lip.
This is Imani. This is the Far Side.
That's who we are. Yo, check it out, we just chilling, you know what I'm saying? Yo, Imani, what station are we on? CKUT
90.3
FM. Cool it.
Hey, yo, check this out. This is Flavor Flav, and you